You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Hey, Connor, I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Pretty darn good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of this podcast, which is Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of Robert Wright's Non-Zero podcast. You are Dan Grazier, a senior fellow at the Stimson Center and also the director of the National Security Reform Program over there. And I'm having you on today because I saw a really interesting piece from you this week in Responsible Statecraft, in which you laid out an argument about the defensibility of Taiwan that is so different than what you usually hear in Washington. You know, we usually hear that we need to direct our entire military industrial complex, all of our efforts towards defending Taiwan. But your view seems to be much more in the direction that an invasion of Taiwan is actually exceedingly unlikely. And so that's kind of the argument that I want to unpack with you today. So maybe to start off, can you lay out the basics of that argument for our listeners?
Sure. Well, you know, kind of like you said, you know, the defending Taiwan, you know, the prospect of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan has been like the sole, you know, almost exclusively the main, you know, the main scenario around which U.S. defense planners craft all defense policies and budgets here for about the last 10 years. And just with my background makes me quite skeptical of, you know, of that scenario. I just don't think it's particularly realistic. And what particularly bothers me about all of this is, you know, you see defense policy leaders, both, you know, civilians and military, like over the last 10 years, it spans, you know, multiple administrations. I mean, it just goes back a long way now. They just toss out the prospect of China invading Taiwan as kind of a talking point. And hardly anybody ever really considers, well, what is that scenario? What would that actually look like? And, right, you know, how suitable is Taiwan for what would be the largest military operation in history? And, yeah, I mean, I have a background in the Marine Corps as both a tank officer, so I understand like the ground combat side of this. But I'm also a graduate of Expeditionary Warfare School, which means that I was once upon a time a fully qualified amphibious planner, and you know, so I understand both sides of that scenario, and every bit of experience that I have leads me to believe that, you know, just the military argument alone with the Taiwan scenario makes it extremely unlikely. But then when you factor in the various like strategic, you know, geostrategic considerations, and then the political and economic considerations that the Chinese leadership would have to factor into making that kind of a decision, then, you know, I think an invasion, like a big, massive amphibious operation, the kind of which that justifies, that's used to justify a $1 trillion annual defense budget here in Washington, it doesn't even become theoretically possible.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's dig in a little bit to the details of the sort of geographic particularities of Taiwan. Like, what makes it so difficult to mount an amphibious invasion, starting from China? Maybe we can go all the way back to the beginning of that concept of crossing the strait, and then up to the actual prospect of landing on Taiwan.
Sure. So, in the course of the research that I've done, including I've spent 20 days on the ground in Taiwan itself, you know, I've identified 8 major challenges that an invader of Taiwan would have to overcome. The first is just crossing crossing the sea to get to the island in the first place. And you know, the size of the force that it would take to conquer a place like Taiwan is huge. And you know, in the 21st century, with you know, spy satellites and, you know, signals intelligence and even open source intelligence like social media, you know, the massing of that amount of combat power would not go unnoticed. And so the defenders of Taiwan, both on the island itself and then potential allies around the world, they would see that, you know, those kind of military preparations. And, you know, so just, you know, trying to achieve the level of like tactical surprise that would, you know, give an invasion force a fighting chance, you know, is next to impossible in the 21st century. So an invader would chase, you know, alerted defenders, you know, both on the island and off the island. So just crossing the sea would be a difficult challenge. And then identifying a landing spot in Taiwan is really difficult because, yeah, it's an island, it's surrounded by water, but there are actually very few usable landing beaches on the island of Taiwan itself, because most of the coastline is cliffs. You know, cliffs that rise like far up into the sky, because Taiwan is extremely mountainous, much more so than I think anybody who's never seen the island understands. Taiwan actually has the tallest mountains in East Asia, the tallest of which, Yushan, is nearly 13,000 feet tall. So these are highly respectable mountains, and they cover the majority of the land space. 60% of the main island of Taiwan is covered by the Central Mountain Range. Which means that the other 40% of the island that isn't covered by mountains has to be very carefully managed. You know, and the only way that you can cram a population of 24 million people into that kind of, you know, restricted land space is to concentrate everybody into major cities. And Taiwan cities are very large and very dense. And then to feed the population, you have to maximize every other inch of flat ground on the island for agricultural purposes. And because we're talking about a subtropical Asian, you know, Asian island, most of the agriculture outside of the cities are rice paddies. Guess what can't cross a rice paddy? A tank. And yeah, you would need a lot of armor to conquer Taiwan. So there's very little usable ground for, you know, these kind of military operations. So identifying just a landing spot is a challenge because of the very few spots on the island that could be used for a landing, they're either directly adjacent to a city, so a force would land and then immediately have the prospect, the deeply unappealing prospect of fighting in a dense urban environment, or they land on a beach and then they have to, you know, try to cross miles and miles of rice paddies, which offer very little in the way of cover and concealment. And they offer almost no space whatsoever to stage combat power. Once you establish a beachhead in an amphibious operation, you're going to have to kind of expand it a little bit while you bring more combat power ashore for the eventual breakout. And because you either have to do that in a city or in vast fields of rice paddies, there's very little usable space to actually stage that kind of combat power while you're still trying to defend your position from being tossed back into the sea. So those are a couple challenges. And then the breakout, you know, trying to maneuver, brigades and even divisions of mechanized ground forces across through the rice paddies or through the cities, it becomes a big challenge because, again, tanks can't cross rice paddies. So they're restricted to either the surface roads through the farm fields, which are extremely narrow and offer very little in the, way of maneuver space. You know, if the lead vehicle in one of these surface roads gets disabled, then the only choice that the following forces have is to basically pivot steer and find another direction, because they can't bypass because they'd end up in the rice paddies on either side. And they'd have a hard time like moving that vehicle out of the way. Because again, if you try pushing it out of the way, the follow-on vehicle is probably going in the rice paddy as well. And then the surface, Taiwan's a developed island. So there are plenty of highways, but most of those highways are elevated in order to get around the rice paddies and cross all the, all the canals and waterways. And so for the defender's point of view, It would be ideal to get an invader on those highways, because all you have to do is drop a bridge section, and then all of a sudden you have like a brigade of tanks that's all stacked up in a line on this road that can't go forward. They can't go around because, again, they'd get stuck on the rice paddies on either side. And they're up high in an elevated position, which means they'd be ideal targets for the defenders, who are, in a lot of cases, going to be hiding in the mountains, which are always visible, almost always visible, just off in the distance. Right. And so defenders with long-range precision missiles would have a field day with tanks just stuck up high in an elevated position, on an elevated and exposed position. And then there's the challenges of restricted terrain, because in many places that flat ground gets, comes to choke points up against the shore because the mountains jog out towards the ocean. And then an invader would have to conquer Taipei. Taipei is a massive city, of over 7 million people. It's built in an ancient lake bed. So it's surrounded on all sides by mountains, which means that the approaches to the city are difficult because they're very narrow river valleys in many cases. So those are easily defended. So if an invader gets all the way through, like all those other challenges in the rest of the country, and they fight through the approaches to Taipei, then their reward is to then fight in Taipei, which is a big, massive, big, massive, dense city. And urban combat is just awful. Even under ideal circumstances. And in this case, the scale of it is, it's beyond anybody's reasonable comprehension. The world has never, ever seen anything quite like that. And so just for those reasons, there's very practical military challenges that are involved in this. And, the purpose of our research is to make that public, because people just don't think about the Taiwan scenario from that perspective. But Chinese military planners have to. And we're trying to show that, we're trying to tell that part of the story. At some point, if this were to kick off, somebody in China would have to make that decision. And they would have to calculate that they could overcome all of these challenges to achieve the full political takeover of Taiwan. In a short amount of time, and within the bounds of acceptable losses, and that's the part that I just don't see. I just don't see the reasonable possibility of success on that front.
Yeah, and what, assuming the narrowest possible defense for Taiwan, assuming that only the Taiwanese military fights, the U.S. doesn't join, no other countries join, what would you assess to be the necessary fighting force that China would have to bring with it in order to conquer the island? Like, what would you, if you were planning an amphibious operation, bring with you in order to win that fight?
Well, just from a number standpoint, and this is just my experience as a military planner, and this is, Chinese military doctrine, I think, is a little bit different, but American military doctrine, when you're planning when you're playing an offensive operation against a deliberate defense, you want to have at least 3-to-1 odds. You want three attackers to fight every defender. So just based on that, we'll just take just the size of the ROC army, which includes the active duty and the reserves. That's a little over 1.5 million million soldiers. So just 3-to-1, based on that, you need a force of nearly 5 million, to invade, to stand a reasonable chance of conquering Taiwan. And the People's Liberation Army is not anywhere close to that size.
Well, I'm curious then, how does this analysis factor into the argument that China is preparing to be ready for an invasion in 2027, right? To the extent that we have, visibility into China's thought process on this, like, why, given all these obstacles, do they seem to think it might be possible to be prepared for an invasion by then?
Well, that's a great question. And I certainly have some ideas about this. And you have to think kind of big picture what the what China's leaders view as their strategic imperatives. Now, I'm going to caveat all of this by saying that I take the Chinese leaders, Chinese leadership at their word that they want to regain full political control of Taiwan. Like, I absolutely believe Xi Jinping when he says that, that he wants to regain full political control of Taiwan. What I'm saying is that the Chinese leadership is not going to resort to military means to accomplish that. Like, they're going to take every other possible course of action, and only if there is absolute, if they're forced into it, will they order an invasion. Now, beyond that, there's a lot of value for the for Chinese leadership in saying that they want to conquer Taiwan. For one thing, it gives them the rationale to increase their own military capabilities, which are defensive in nature. If you look really hard at what the Chinese are doing, they're essentially building a fortress fleet. Because the overall Chinese strategic goal is to keep everyone out of China. They want to avoid another century of humiliation where a lot of outside invaders came in and took over parts of China. They want to avoid that. And so they're trying, so the Chinese are trying to make themselves look as strong as possible in their own backyard to keep any potential invader of China as far away as possible. Now, beyond that, the Chinese also paid attention to what happened in the late 80s and early 90s. They saw the Soviet Union collapse. And part of the reason the Soviet Union collapsed is because the Soviet leaders attempted to keep up with the United States and our military buildup. Now, the Reagan buildup was not, the original purpose of that was not to bankrupt the Soviet Union. That was just ended up being what happened. And then, they came backward, they came back later and said that, that was the plan all along. Well, that's not entirely true. But the Chinese saw that. They learned that lesson. And so now they have an opportunity to try to do that to us because the Chinese, all the Chinese have to do is mess around with aircraft carriers just a little bit and, or state that they're going to mess around with aircraft carriers. They are a little bit. But then that prompts the United States to then invest very heavily in aircraft carriers. And when we do it, it's much more expensive for us, to build aircraft, to actually build aircraft carriers than for the Chinese to just kind of play around with aircraft carriers like they've been doing for the last 25 years. It's the same thing with bombers and fighter jets. The Chinese can announce plans for building, for building out some military capabilities. And then that prompts the United States, like our leaders here, to then like really heavily invest in programs like the B-21 and now the F-47 to try to combat these, purported Chinese military capabilities. Because the Chinese they can afford to do those kind of plans because they basically spend pennies when we're expending dollars. And so they have a great economic advantage over us, with that. And they also see that when we do spend crazy amounts of money on programs, we produce things like the F-35s. That is a 30%, full mission capable rate. We spend it on programs like the Littoral Combat Ship, which has proved to be a complete and total failure. Same thing with
called the by some the little crappy ship, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. Like from the Chinese perspective, like it's like the greatest thing in the world to goad the United States into increasing defense spending because we're just going to waste a lot of money on programs that aren't terribly effective. So, what does it really cost the Chinese?
Right. And so if China is, you're laying out the view that basically they view it as in their interest for us to just keep spending in profligate ways and for them to sort of prepare, but with probably the knowledge that it will be difficult to invade Taiwan. So what would a better response from the U.S. point of view be? And maybe we should get into a second, like what else China might do as well to try to reincorporate Taiwan, but we can address that after. But like, how should the U.S. be dealing with this?
So I think what we should be doing is we need to take a look at what it would take for an invasion of Taiwan to happen, and then to take the minimum steps possible to keep the cost of doing so high. And I've done this, and like an invader of Taiwan would have to transport massive amounts of combat vehicles, supplies, and troops. And the only way that you can do that is on the surface of the sea. Like, you can fly some stuff in, but the bulk of the combat power for an invader would have to come on the surface. And so the way that you deal with that is to, I would invest heavily in attack submarines, and not necessarily nuclear attack submarines. There are highly effective small air independent propulsion attack submarines that are built around the world, mostly by Sweden, that they could be, we could purchase about six of those for the cost of one Virginia class attack submarine. And so I would invest, I would invest in that by the American Navy, and I would encourage our allies in the region. Instead of AUKUS being a deal to sell Virginia class nuclear attack submarines to, five of them to Australia, I would suggest, why don't we, shift that effort and instead buy 30 air independent propulsion attack submarines. And so if the Chinese decided that they were going to launch this invasion again, they wouldn't be able to hide those preparations. So the defenders of Taiwan have an opportunity to move forces into place, to defend against it. And if the Taiwan Strait is just completely seated with a bunch of attack submarines, and then other forces, air forces and long range missiles that can target surface vessels effectively. I think that by itself would be enough to dissuade any potential invasion of Taiwan. Now, if the Chinese start losing a bunch of surface ships, before they even get to the shoreline, then what's the whole point?
That's interesting. So, it's almost before, because a lot of people talk about a porcupine strategy for Taiwan, whereby you don't want to eat a porcupine, right? You make it difficult to devour. And the idea is that you have a bunch of like missiles that can fire at ships coming across and also at people that are landing. So you're saying that even before we're talking about landing, there can be huge steps taken at relatively lower cost than we're currently doing to prevent an invasion.
No, absolutely. The submarine plan would be an excellent deterrent. For a number of different reasons. Like, one, it's really difficult to defend against submarines, and even into the 21st century, it is still exceedingly difficult to defend effectively against submarines. And I love the saying that the submariners have, that in naval matters, there are submarines and there are targets. That would be a highly effective defensive strategy. But it's also, from a signaling standpoint, I think it's also important as well, because submarines are they're great weapons in kind of an offensive defensive role, if that makes any sense. You push submarines forward, and attack submarines would be very effective against surface ships. But you can't use submarines you can't use submarines to project military power. You can't use submarines to go land large forces, on mainland China, as part of an invasion. If we bolstered our submarine force, in a way, it's not really escalatory, because the signal is, look, if You don't want to tangle their submarines. Don't sortie your fleet, for, a cross-strait, cross-strait invasion. But we can't use our submarines to project military power in any significant way into, in the mainland China. So there's a great signaling thing. It's like, look, we have this to defend against you in case you become aggressive, but we can't use this to really threaten your very existence.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. And so to what extent is Taiwan taking steps that you think are in the right direction for its own security? Do you think that the Taiwanese military it's not buying, I guess, these submarines, but is it buying other weapons that you think will be the sort of right mix in order to defend against a Chinese invasion?
Well, so I've certainly looked into, Taiwan's military preparations. I did deliberately avoid getting into that in any deep, meaningful way for this project for two reasons. Like, one, I did spend 20 days on the ground in Taiwan, and I was fully aware of the situation. I'm a bit of a shadowy American military figure who was wandering around in a foreign country trying to figure out how to invade it. And so I was very careful not to draw a whole lot of attention to myself, but I'm certainly not poking around military sites. When I was there, because my point with my research is just to lay out like a very very granular kind of bare bones facts about the scenario, my time on the ground was important because it's really difficult to understand scale from like shadowing imagery and just from pictures and videos. And so it was important for me to be on the ground just to get that kind of tactile sense of how all the different types of terrain in Taiwan kind of interacted and influenced each other. I did try to deliberately avoid a lot of that really detailed analysis of Taiwan's military preparations. There are other scholars who have done, done some of that. My point with this was to point out that, in spite of anything that the Taiwanese might be doing as far as their own military preparations, that just the terrain and the geography involved in this scenario make an invasion very difficult by itself. So any military preparations on top of that just complicates matters further.
Yeah. Yeah. One interesting one thing I'm curious to get your thoughts on is that, a critic might say, well, any sort of amphibious operation is super difficult, right? We've seen that throughout history. Normandy was super difficult, but there was a very strong incentive to do it. And so we did it, right? How do you deal with those historical antecedents and think about the question of like Chinese resolve here, I guess.
Well, I can assure you that yes, that anybody who I would be very skeptical of anybody who tried to make the argument that an amphibious operation would be simple, because they are extremely difficult. There's just so many different moving parts and like all the different planning factors that you have to consider. It's a very difficult challenge, even under ideal circumstances. And Normandy happened only because the people involved had a lot of very recent practical experience planning and conducting amphibious operations. An invader of Taiwan here in the 21st century would not have that same level of experience. So that's something to consider here. The practical challenges of assembling the necessary forces. We can stick to the D-Day example. Because it's a pretty good one. That required 7,000 separate naval vessels. It was 195,000 soldiers, more than 200,000 naval personnel that were involved in just the first day's landing of D-Day. It took 6 months to plan. It took an enormous deception operation to to make that happen. But that happened in that happened in 1944. So it happened in the days before satellite. It happened, before highly effective signals intelligence. In 1944, you had a bunch of people that were listening to Morse code messages. Today, the defenders of Taiwan, they have they have the opportunity to look through social media posts and news reports to prepare. There's also been a major shift, major advances in technology. We have uncrewed naval vessels that can be used in an attack role. I mean, look at what the Ukrainians have done in the Black Sea over the last couple of years. Like, they've effectively removed freedom of navigation from the Russian Navy in the Black Sea. And the Ukrainians have done that without a surface fleet, really. They did that mostly with shore-based missiles and uncrewed attack vessels. The Taiwanese would have the opportunity to do the exact same thing to any potential invader of their island. And so it's difficult to make a one-for-one analogy just because so many things have changed since the last time we've really seen a major amphibious operation.
Yeah, and I guess if we're making the assumption that China is not going to pursue an invasion option, but also have the assumption in mind that China is very determined to make Taiwan a part of mainland China again, or a part of the political system in mainland China, then what other things might we expect them to try, and how could we deal with those?
Sure. Well, that's the great challenge here, because it does become a little dicey when we start thinking about the other means that the Chinese might do to reunite or to bring Taiwan back into the mainland fold. So the argument that I'm making is that if the Chinese do regain full political control of Taiwan, they're going to do it in a way that's going to look a whole lot more like how they regained control of Hong Kong than it would be how we landed forces in northern France in 1944. So I believe that the Chinese are going to, they're going to try to, figure out some diplomatic or political, political scheme to accomplish their goal. Rather than the full invasion, and they're patient. They're willing to wait for something like this to happen. I don't remember exactly how long. What was the lag? I should know this off the top of my head. Between the treaty signing with the United Kingdom and the takeover of Hong Kong in 1997, if I remember correctly. There was a long time in between those two, in between those two events. And so, the Chinese are, they're patient. Chinese history goes back a lot longer than ours. And frankly, if you go to Taiwan, you get a really good sense of that. You go visit the National Palace Museum, because in that museum, you see Chinese treasures going back thousands of years. I guess I always kind of understood that China was an ancient civilization, but until I was actually there and I saw these displays of objects that date back to like 5,000 BC, I didn't really fully appreciate just how long, how long that is. And so I think the Chinese are willing to wait and play a long game and try to manipulate the political system in Taiwan, to influence the Taiwanese electorate, to elect a government that would be more amenable to some sort of a reconciliation or agreement with the Chinese on the mainland. It will be something like that. And then what we do on the in response, that becomes a little dicey, because I don't know, let's say the citizens of Taiwan do elect a government at some point that is willing to open negotiations with, for reunification with the mainland. what do we do at that point? Are we going to like intervene like militarily, or, you know, try to, you know, throw up, you know, some kind of roadblocks to some kind of an agree like that? Would that even be appropriate? I have my doubts that, you know, that we would. Like, nobody stepped in to stop the Chinese from taking over Hong Kong after that treaty had been negotiated. So I think that the Chinese are far more likely to pursue some method like this. And then, you know, at that point, I don't know that it would be appropriate for anybody else to intervene and prevent that kind of a reunification at that point.
Right. And what about the possibility of a military blockade? Like, what would we do in order to either deter the possibility of China doing a blockade or to break one if one were to happen?
Well, so I think a blockade, is almost more dangerous than a full invasion. Cause you have to think about threshold. Like if the Chinese launch a full invasion, like right now, and they're able to pull off, you know, some remarkable, you know, surprise attack, you know, that we weren't able to anticipate, you know, at that point, I don't know, it might be kind of, viewed as a fait accompli. And then at that point, you know, there might be a chance we don't intervene. But a blockade, though, is kind of like an incremental step on both sides. You know, so a blockade would take time to have an effect. And so there would be more time to kind of deliberate, you know, what the next step is. And, trying to break a blockade by, you know, some kind of like, you know, like naval skirmish, you know, try to break a blockade, you know, maybe open up, a shipping lane into Kaohsiung or something. It would be kind of like one thing for the president of the United States to order, some kind of a blockade run, than it would be to order, like a full, counterattack against an invasion force, if that makes any sense. So kind of a minor thing, to order a couple, salvos from a naval squadron, than it is to launch like a full counterattack. But it would still be a direct military confrontation. All the risks of escalation, would be there, but the threshold for starting that is a lot lower. That's why I say that I think a blockade would almost be more dangerous from an escalatory standpoint than a full invasion. My co-authors and I, in the bigger report, upon which this responsible statecraft piece was based, we definitely talk about the other potential scenarios that are kind of below that, the full invasion, threshold. They're all dangerous in their own way. All of them kind of threaten a direct military confrontation between China and the United States, which is something that I think both sides want to, really do want to avoid, because again, like any direct military confrontation, runs the risk of escalation up and including a nuclear exchange. I think that all of these military means are highly unlikely just for that purpose. The risk of escalation to a nuclear exchange is the strongest argument against any kind of military action against Taiwan.
Right. Right. That's all, terrifying, but I think that there are a lot of terrifying aspects of this kind of from top to bottom. Something I wanted to pull back and do sort of a broader thing, because I'm curious, the way that you lay it out, it just seems like this is an eminently manageable threat, right? That this is at least the threat of an actual full-scale invasion is not necessarily something that we need to build the entire U.S. defense posture around. And yet that is what we're doing. So why does the Pentagon and why do members of Congress, why does the Trump administration and the Biden administration view this differently than you do?
Well,
this was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.